Well, here we are, and tomorrow, about this time, Passover starts. So tomorrow is the day of preparation, and it would be the day, which happens to be also on a Wednesday, which when Jesus Christ actually really died, it was a Wednesday. It happened to fall on the same day of the week as it is this year. Which is kind of nice. I mean, well, nice. I mean, it's interesting that it did, you know. So as we go through this, we see these things. So last week, we looked at the records of the trials that Jesus Christ went through. He was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. He was betrayed by Judas. And they sent a whole slew of people, you know, like a small army, to arrest him. Just one guy with a couple of fishermen, and they send an army. And when they ask who he was, he steps forward and they fall backward. So he was not afraid. He stood up and he said, "I'm the guy." And so then they took him away and they took him to the home of Annas, who was previously the high priest. And there he was questioned and beaten up a little bit. And then he was taken to the house of Caiaphas, who was the present high priest. Now, Annas and Caiaphas were related. I think Caiaphas was Annas' son-in-law. And they were Sadducees. And they were not of the line of Aaron, but they were installed by the Romans. The Romans controlled it. So, but they were religious Jews to some extent. So, you know, even in the garden when Jesus Christ was praying, Peter, James, and John fell asleep on him twice. And so he wasn't getting a lot of cooperation from anyone. And then they took him away and they took him to these trials. And then when they finished at Caiaphas's, they took him to Pilate at the Praetorium. So before we go any further tonight and look at the crucifixion, or, you know, the crucifixion, we're going to go back to where we started a little bit. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. And it says, "For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities or our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted like we are, or as we are, yet without sin." Jesus Christ was tempted in every way possible that you and I, that any human being could ever be tested or tempted. He had to deal with it. He had to refuse it. He had to walk away from it. He didn't allow his mind to go there. It says that he was tempted in all ways, and yet he was without sin. So that's pretty amazing. Then it says in verse 16, "Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in the time of need." And we can go before that throne of grace with boldness because Jesus Christ did handle those temptations, because he was without sin, because he conquered them for us. And then in chapter 5, verse 7, it says, "Who in the days of his flesh," speaking of Jesus Christ, "when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him," unto God, "that was able to save him from death and was heard in that he feared," or respected. He had great reverence for God. That's what it's talking about there. "Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered," or endured. He learned obedience. You know, back in Luke, in the beginning of Luke, when it talks about Jesus Christ as a child, it says he grew spiritually. And he grew in wisdom. Here it said, he learned obedience. So one of the great things about Jesus Christ is his example to us. He is the greatest example of obedience. He was obedient to God in every way and everything. In his believing, he always believed God. He never pulled back or hesitated. In humility, he always did the Father's will. He always listened to God and was attentive to what he said to him. And he was our example in thankfulness. He was always thankful to God. And as well, he had great respect and love for his Father. You know, he just had that absolute love and respect for God, his Father. And he said, I always do the things that please him. You know, he was totally a selfless man. So we're going to begin to look at the records of the crucifixion, and I'm going to read from Jesus Christ, Our Passover, pages 213 and 14. Not the whole thing, but a section that starts in 213 and goes through 214. It says, Jesus was taken captive in the Garden of Gethsemane on Monday evening. After many intervening events, Jesus was sent to Pilate to the Praetorium about noon on Tuesday. And so we know what happened. He was taken prisoner, and then he was gone to Annas, like I said, and to Caiaphas, and they questioned him, and they beat him and knocked him around, and then finally they got him to Pilate because they had already decided he deserved and was going to get the sentence of death. But they had to get Pilate to okay it. Right? They had to have his seal of approval. And Pilate really didn't want to, but they put him in a position where he had to. So he was sent to Pilate at the Praetorium about noon on Tuesday. God's words does not give details in terms of what happened from Tuesday afternoon until Wednesday morning. We are informed only that a cohort of Roman soldiers tortured him and mocked him during this time. And we know they beat him, they tortured him, they made fun of him, they did all kinds of things. So now we're going to go back to Matthew chapter 27. And we're going to be in Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23, and John 19. So if you have a Bible, you can mark those places so you can get to them easy. If you're doing like everybody here is on a laptop, they just go to it right away. But I have my Bible marked so I can get there quick. So Matthew 27, and we're starting verse 31. And this particular part reads the same in Mark and Luke. Verse 31, it says, and after that they had mocked him. Now remember, let's see. We'll go up to verse 29. This is where, Pilate has decided to free Barabbas instead, or the people want Barabbas freed. And so then the soldiers take him. It says in verse 29, when they had platted a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. And they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. So they were beating him up pretty good. And after that they had mocked him, they took the robe off from him and put his own raiment on him and led him away to crucify him. In Moulton's analytical Greek lexicon, he said the word led could also be translated dragged or carried. I didn't read any other lexicon that said that. I looked up in Thayer's and I looked up in Bullinger's and something else I can't remember. But they didn't share the same thing. But you can imagine he was a prisoner. He was beaten. He had been up for a couple of days. He didn't get any sleep. He wasn't getting fed. So they probably had to probably drag him to get him wherever they wanted him to go. So, and as they came out, They came out of the praetorium, out of the courtyard or whatever. As they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. So this guy is probably in Jerusalem for the Passover. He's from Cyrene, a city, I forget where that is exactly, but he's from Cyrene and he's there to obey the law, to come and celebrate the feast of the Passover. And he happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or maybe in the right place, because everybody in history knows him now. And they compel him. They didn't say, excuse me, sir, would you mind carrying this cross? They compelled him. They made him. He didn't have a choice. It's pretty crazy. He didn't have a choice. So he was made to carry the cross. Now, the cross probably would have been either a tree trunk or a large beam. Now, there's, you know, debates over this. But the Greek word for cross here is the word for just a piece of wood, a stake. So that's what we believe it was. But at any rate, it would have to have been pretty big and pretty strong to hold a man's body. So if you've ever tried to lift up even a small tree trunk, they're pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. Or a beam, like a 4x4 beam, and it would have to be at least, you know, 8 or 9 feet long. It's pretty heavy. So having not slept for 2 days, being beaten and mocked, Jesus Christ was probably not even able to carry the cross, even if they had wanted him to. So let's go to John chapter 19. And verse 16 is where we're going to start here. And it says, then delivered he him therefore unto them, he being Pilate. He had delivered them therefore unto them to be crucified. And they took Jesus and led him away. And he bearing his cross. Now, we know it wasn't Jesus Christ. It was Simon that carried the physical cross. He bearing the cross went forth into the place of the skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. So the word bearing here is bastazo, B-A-S-T-A-Z-O. It means to lift or carry. And it is used of physical burdens, but it is also used as well for mental or spiritual burdens. So I believe in, where is it, Galatians? It talks about being burden bearers. Okay, Isaiah 53:6, it says, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. So that is the real cross that Jesus Christ bore. Yeah. The physical cross was one thing, but the greater burden was the spiritual burden. The burden that Jesus Christ carried was much greater than the physical cross, but he did take the physical beatings. He did take the torture. He took the shame, the rejection for all mankind to redeem us all that believe on him. In Colossians 2, verse 14, it says, blotting out the handwriting of our ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. And of course, that refers to that Oriental custom where if somebody was in debt, they would put it up on the gate of the city and for everybody to see. So it was a matter of shame. This guy doesn't pay his debt. We used to say in high school, we'd call him a welcher if you didn't pay what you owed somebody, right? And then if somebody came along and paid that debt, they would fold it over, close it up, and they would put paid in full on it. And so that's what Jesus Christ did for us. He took all the accusations, all that we would have had to pay, and he paid it by nailing it to his cross. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, it says, "For he, God, I'm adding God, for he, who is God, hath made him, Jesus Christ, to be sin for us, who knew no sin, that he might be made that we might be made the righteousness of God in him," in Christ. So again, he didn't have any sin. He was tempted in all ways, but without sin. He had pure and perfect blood. He was the innocent lamb that was slayed or killed for the guilty. That's why he's called the Passover lamb. He was the innocent lamb that paid the price for all of us. In 1 Corinthians 1, 17 and 18, it says, "For Christ sent me," that's Paul speaking, "not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God." So, what a great thing. So, let's go to Luke chapter 23. And we're going to start in verse 27. But the true cross that Christ bore stands for our release from all the bondage of law, sin, sickness, and guilt. On the walk to Calvary by Jesus Christ with Simon carrying his cross in front of him, several important events occurred. So we're going to go through those events as he walked from the Praetorium to the place of the skull called Calvary, or Golgotha. So in verse 27, it says, "And there followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him." So you could imagine, he comes out from his trial where the people, when Pilate says, on this feast day, it's a tradition that you can ask for anyone to be freed. And here's Jesus and I can free him. And they go, "No, we want Barabbas." And he says, "This guy hasn't done anything wrong." And they go, "Crucify him, crucify him." They were whipped up into a frenzy. And so he's walking, they're dragging him along. Simon is following with the cross. And there's a great company of people. And you could imagine the mixture of people, right? Certainly there's always people. When anything's going on, they just want to see it. You know, if there's a fire, they want to see. If there's an accident, they want to see the bloodiest thing of it. You know, there's people like that. They just are. They just want to see horrible things. And then there were other people that, were pushing this whole thing. But it says here, these women were behind him wailing and lamenting him. And I don't really know. All we can do is take it for what it is. It might have been those women that were his disciples that had been following him. We know that the apostles took off. They deserted him. They left. But the women stayed around, as we'll see later. So these women bewailed and lamented. Did you ever see... sometimes you see in movies or you see in the Middle East where when somebody dies, they're very, very overtly emotional. And even at times, we know that there were hired professional mourners and people that would do this for a living. And they could cry and scream and yell really well. So Verse 28. But Jesus, turning unto them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. Now, this is pretty crazy because Jesus Christ is on his way to die, and these people are wailing and lamenting him, and he takes time to tell them something and teach them something. He says in verse 29, For behold, the days are coming in the which they shall say, Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bare, and the paps which never gave suck. So this all refers to women, right? The worst thing that could, the worst curse in the East that a woman could have was not have children. And here he says, you know, they'll say, Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bare, and the paps which never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. So, in other words, bad days are ahead. That's what he's telling them. Bad days are coming. You're crying and lamenting for me. You should be lamenting and crying for yourself. Then he says, For they do these things in a green tree. What shall be done in the dry? You know, what is he saying here? He says, you know, they're doing this now when the Messiah is here on earth, when it's a good time. But what's going to happen when I'm gone and there's a drought? If you hold your place here and go to the first Psalm. Kind of relates to this a little bit. In verse 1 it says, Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, but sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. So, and then it says, For the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. So Jesus Christ is saying, you know, this place is ungodly and the drought is coming. And those that believe on me, you know, they'll be okay, but the others are in trouble. So, so he says, For if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? And there were also two other malefactors led with him to be put to death. So, these are the malefactors. Malefactors are evildoers. Evildoers, people that are, you know, generally just bad. Mm-hmm. They might be thieves and robbers one day. They might be con men the next. They might be mugging people another day. You know, they're just bad people. Malefactors. Okay, we're going to go to Mark 15. Mark 15 and verse 22. So again, so they were bringing him to Golgotha at that point, right? And they said two malefactors were with him, you know, in the parade, we could say, you know, in the group where he's marching along. And they bring him unto the place, Golgotha, which being interpreted, the place of the skull. And they gave him to drink wine mingled with myrrh, but he received it not. This is pretty interesting. Myrrh, we know, when the wise men came, one of the gifts they gave was myrrh, right? Frankincense, myrrh, and gold. And myrrh is a resin, a resinous gum that comes from a plant. And it's called camphora, not to be confused with camphor, which is a distillate, a ketone, that they put in stuff to reject insects and stuff, right? But myrrh is a resinous gum that's used, and it's used to make incense, and it's used to make ointments, and used in perfume, things like that. And it's very, very valuable. But when its wine is mingled with some myrrh, this drink was used as an anesthetic to deaden some of the pain. So they were offering him this now. Well, we're going to see they offer it a second time. But Jesus refused this. And we could look at it and we could say, well, why did he refuse it? Well, because he had to go through all the pain and suffering. So he was always, we know that he always did what his father told him to do. So even though it would have helped him with the pain he was going through, he refused it because God told him to. Because to fulfill what he had to fulfill, to totally redeem us, he had to feel all that pain. How crazy. Boy, what an amazing man. And he had to fulfill it so that he could redeem us. He always did the Father's will. Now we're going to go back to Matthew chapter 27 and verse 33. And when they were come to the place called Golgotha, that is to say the place of the skull, they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall. So when he was on his way, they offered him the wine mixed with myrrh. When he got there, then they offered him vinegar mixed with gall. Vinegar is really not vinegar. It's the word oxos. It means a cheap, sour-tasting wine. And gall, when it's mixed with whatever gall was, again, it was an anodyne or a pain reliever. And so, now, this is the interesting part. Let's go to hold your place there, go to Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 and verse 6. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that be of heavy hearts. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Apparently, in Jerusalem, there was this association of women or society of women that whenever somebody was condemned or whenever somebody one of the things they would do sometimes if somebody committed a sin or broke the law, it would be 40 stripes save one. So obviously those people would be in great pain, right? Or they were going to get stoned. The society of women would come and bring this either the wine mixed with myrrh or the cheap wine mixed with gall to help relieve some of the pain. Pretty wild. I said, wow, that's interesting. But that verse in Proverbs, give them strong drink. So that seems to be what was happening. Maybe some of those women were there, and they were offering that to him. But again, what does it say here?
He wouldn't drink. Verse 34.
Verse 34, right? Okay, I lost my place now. We're in Matthew 27, right?
Right.
Matthew 27. Okay, I'm down here now. 34, right. And they gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall, and when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. So as soon as he touched his lips, he refused it. Again, why? Because he had to suffer. He had to take on all those pains, all those sufferings that we would take on so that he could redeem us. Let's go next to Luke, Gospel of Luke, chapter 23. And we'll begin in verse 33. 23:33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, again, Golgotha, or the place of the skull, there they crucified him, and the malefactors, one on the right hand, the other on the left. So that's the actual crucifixion. Now, when they did a crucifixion, this is also, they would lay the cross down on the ground, and then the condemned man would lay on top of it, and they would put a little notch or a place to hold his feet, and then they would drive a spike through his feet, and then they would drive a spike through his hands up above, so it was held. And then they would tie a rope around his waist, and then they would slide the cross, the beam or the tree or whatever it was, into a hole and stand it up. Now, I've thought about this a lot. The Romans didn't really like the Jews. They were really a pain in the neck to them. And they didn't really care about Israel as a country. It was really more that it was on an important trade route and a land bridge between Europe, Asia, and North Africa, which at the time, North Africa was a very important part of the Roman Empire. Egypt was the main supplier of grain for Italy. So, plus, they wanted to control the whole Mediterranean basin. There's not a lot of trees and there's not a lot of wood in Jerusalem. You know, and there's not a lot of forest. When they built the temple, they had to bring cedars down from Lebanon, you know. So they didn't waste a lot of wood and time building crosses for lowly criminals. You know, whatever they could get away with that would do the job, would that's what they would use. You know, and they didn't, it wasn't probably standing up perfectly straight because they just dumped it in a hole. We'll go into this a little more as we go along. But the two malefactors are crucified with Jesus Christ, one on the right hand and one on the left. Then said Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they parted his raiment and cast lots. So the soldiers there, they took his raiment, they took his robe and they, or his garment, and they cut it in pieces and they gambled to get pieces of it. And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also with them derided him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God." So first he says, "Father, forgive them." Some texts remove that. They don't have that in there. But the majority of them do. And this, we know from Mark, occurred at the third hour, or about 9 a.m. So Jesus Christ is up for at least two full days at this point. Verse 35, "And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also with them derided him, saying, 'He saved others, let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God.'" You know, the devil, again, inspired these people. What was the first thing, the first temptation that Jesus Christ encountered when he came out of the wilderness? Yeah, "If thou be the Son of God, make these rocks bread." You know, if you're really the Son of God. Then he took him up on the temple. He said, "If you're really God's son, jump off, because it says the angels will hold you up." You know, he was always challenging Jesus Christ to who he really is. And here again, once more, he's tempting him. You know, and Jesus Christ could have walked off that cross at any time. Yep. We know that. He said, "I have at my disposal 12 legions of angels," which is 72,000 angels. They derided him, which literally means they turned up their nose at him. Isn't that something? They turned up their noses. "And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar. You know, the soldiers. Soldiers in the Roman Empire were an interesting group. We could go into it. It really not pertains to this, but they were an interesting group. And they weren't the cream of society. Let's put it that way. And the way they got paid is by the spoils of war. That's how they really got paid. So they mocked him and they offered him vinegar and saying, if thou be the king of the Jews, save thyself. So again, you know, this is a challenge. This is a temptation. If you're really the king, why can't you save yourself? Trying to get him to doubt who he is. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. This is the king of the Jews. A superscription simply means it was put over his head, right? Now, one of the customs or one of the things that they did when a man was condemned, they would make a placard usually and it would be covered in like a gypsum, like a light plaster. And then they would write on it. So if a guy was a murderer, they would put murderer. Or if he was a rapist, they put rapist or whatever, and they would hang it around his neck. But with Jesus Christ, because it was a long inscription, they may have had somebody to walk before him like a herald saying this to mock him even more. So, so anyway, Satan is going crazy here trying to get Jesus Christ to doubt who he is. And so they put this superscription over him. And it was in Greek and Latin and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. Let's go to John chapter 19. And verse 19, it says, and Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. This title read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh to the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Greek and Latin. Then said the chief priests of the Jews to Pilate, write not the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. Now, if you read in the different Gospels, the superscription varies a little bit. And the explanation simply is it's in three different languages. So it may have varied in the different languages depending on what was going on. So, but this was the title and it was written in three languages and it was there because Pilate wrote it. So Jesus Christ, our Passover, says, the accusation, superscription over his head was a mockery of both Jesus and the Judeans. It mocked Jesus by showing his claims of kingship juxtaposed with his hanging on a cross. Who could imagine a genuine king being executed as a criminal, looking so pitiful and powerless? The accusation further mocked the Judeans by giving them a king from Galilee who was crucified as a full demonstration of the Roman authority over them. That's pretty interesting. Thought that was something. Death by crucifixion was usually a very slow and difficult way to die. Like I said, they put him up on the cross, they put the nails through him, they tied a rope around him so he couldn't come down. The normal length of time somebody would hang on a cross before they died was about 36 hours. It could go on for days and in some instances a week or more. Can you imagine hanging on a cross? And the way a person dies, of course, is they become dehydrated and then their their system shut down, the vital organs start to shut down, and then, you know, they'll suffocate eventually. If for any reason they wanted to abbreviate this process, they would come and they would break the legs, and if needed, they would impale the condemned person with a spear or a sword. So now let's go back to Luke chapter 23 and verse 39. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, if thou be Christ, save thyself and us. So not only is he getting a grief from all these people that are standing around, the soldiers and some of the priests and some of the other people, but now one of the guys that's being crucified with him, he says, you know, if you're really the Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, dost thou not fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward for our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, and this is the verse that's always screwed up because of the the commas are placed and everything. It says, Jesus said unto him, verily I say unto you today, Jesus Christ is saying, today I'm telling you this, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Certainly he couldn't be with him in paradise that day because Jesus Christ got buried and he was in the ground 3 days and three nights. So that certainly wasn't paradise. So now we go back to Matthew. Matthew 27. And verse 38. Verse 38, it says, then were the two thieves crucified with him, one on the right hand and the other on the left. So first there were two malefactors, evildoers, and they were both crucified with Jesus Christ at the time he was crucified. Then it says here, then were two others, and they are thieves, crucified with him, one on the right hand, the other on the left. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads. They reviled him. And the word reviled is blasphemio, like we get the word blasphemy or blasphemous. It means to speak evil or slander or profane. So the people walked by and they shook their heads and they reviled him and they just said terrible things about him. And saying, thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it again in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross. Wow. Again, how many times does he have to hear this? Likewise, also the chief priests, mocking him with the scribes and elders, said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. If he be the king of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. Mm-hmm. They were liars. They wouldn't have believed no matter what. They saw him do miracles. When he raised Lazarus from the dead, it shook them up, and they said, we got to get rid of this guy because he's going to get a big following and everybody's going to stop listening to us. They didn't believe him at all. They would have never believed him. Then, what do they say in verse 43? He trusted in God. Wow, if he trusted in God, let him, God, deliver him now if he will have him, if God will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. So again, what are they saying? He said, God doesn't want him. Look, he's letting him die. He doesn't want anything to do with him. The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth. See, the evildoers, one reviled him, the other didn't. Mm-hmm. In this case, both thieves, they both said, oh, this guy's wacky. He can't save himself. He can't do anything. Now, from the sixth hour, which is about noon, 12 noon, there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour, which was 3 o'clock. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou? And we know that's a bad translation, and it should read something along the lines of, this is what I was reserved for. Because we know that God did not forsake him. Some of them that stood there when they heard that said, this man calls for Elias, or Elijah. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, let be, let us see whether Elias will come to save him. So here they are and they're going, were they really waiting to see if he would be saved? I don't know. I think, again, they were mocking him. So now we're going to go back to John, the Gospel of John, 19. So that's the crucifixion. Verse 25, now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. So there's all these different women, and so, and they're standing by the cross. Boy, how his mother must have felt at that point. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciples standing by, whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, woman, behold thy son. The disciple he loved, you know, maybe probably Lazarus, that's one of the people it says that he loved. Maybe somebody else. We don't know. Then saith he to the disciple, behold thy mother, and from that hour that disciple took her into his own home. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, saith, I thirst. Now there was set a vessel full of vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it upon a hyssop and put it to his mouth. When Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, it is finished. He bowed his head and gave up the ghost. So Jesus Christ gave up his life. They didn't take it. He gave it up. And that's the crucifixion. And what a horrible way to die. But he was so willing to do everything necessary to redeem us and to obey his Father and go through all that because he loved God and he loved mankind and he was willing to do that to save them. So that's what we're going to stop with tonight.
I think that's enough.
That's a lot. But, you know, it's a really great thing to read about and understand as we go into Resurrection Sunday. Boy, because you really get to appreciate what he did and what he went through for us. Couple of days of pain and torture and abuse and shame and rejection. And because God told him that's what he needed to do to save mankind. So, Father God, we thank you for this day. We thank you for loving us and blessing us. We thank you for what a great God you are. And we thank you for how beautiful it is to see these things and how your son was so brave and so strong and so willing to do whatever you asked him to do. And how he did it to the very best. How he did it so completely that we are righteous in your sight. And we're holy and without blame. We just thank you for that, God. We thank you again and again. And that we can truly be thankful for all you did for us through your Son. That we can really appreciate it and really understand it. And we thank you in his name and pray. Amen.